Welcome to Mix Understood, where we talk about identity, the meaning of the word race, and explore the multicultural and multiracial experience through personal stories, candid conversations, and expert insights. I'm your host, Hannah Lee. Thank you for being here. In today's episode, we have a special appearance from someone you already know pretty well. It's a pre-recorded conversation with my former co-host and dear friend, Amy, before she embarked on her next adventure, which is literally around the corner, baby number two. In this oh-so-intimate discussion, Amy and I delve into our experiences growing up in a mixed-race household, exploring the impacts our parents' marriage had on us as children, as well as on our own mixed marriages. We'll also touch on the landmark Loving versus Virginia case, a pivotal moment in history that legalized interracial marriage in the United States. Last but not least, we have an epic voicemail story from one of our listeners, so stick around to the end if you want to crack up with me. Before we get started, I just wanted to take a moment to express my gratitude to all our listeners. Your support means everything, and if you enjoy this podcast and would like to help keep this conversation going, consider supporting our Patreon at patreon.podbean.com/mixunderstoodpod. I know it's a super long link, so you can also find it in the show notes. Before we dive into this episode, it's important to say that we are here to offer up stories, ideas, and various theories for you to consider and decide for yourself in light of your own knowledge and experience.
We hope to explore, learn, and grow together with you. We're not professing to have the answers. Our aim is just to start the conversations around these topics.
Exactly. And also in this episode, we're going to talk about our parents' interracial marriages. Ideally, we would have had them here with us. They do live quite far away. And
yeah, different time zones as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe we'll do an episode with them actually down the line.
I would love that.
Yeah, that would be amazing. But yeah. Today we're just going to give telling their stories a go with the information that we have. We'll do our best to piece things together with things that we've been told and from our early memories.
Yeah. But it's our personal experience as well. It might differ from our siblings' experience.
Yeah, or how other people remember things in their families, perhaps.
Yeah, so please take that into consideration.
Bear that in mind.
Interracial marriage is a big topic. I've been living in the States for 20 years now. How about you?
Three and a half to four years.
Well, there's all these things I was completely clueless about.
Oh, me too.
So we've been doing a little bit of research and reading and
about the history of interracial marriages, when it became legalized in the States. One of the most famous stories, which we're going to talk about now, is the case of Loving versus Virginia.
Yeah. So in 1967, the Supreme Court rules unanimously that states cannot outlaw marriages between whites and non-whites. In the case of Loving versus Virginia, Mildred Dolores Loving, identified as having Native American and African American ancestry, marries Richard, a white man. She becomes pregnant in 1958.
At that time, 24 states across the country had laws strictly prohibiting marriage between people of different races, including Virginia, which is where they were living at the time. So when they decided to get married, they traveled to Washington, D.C. for the marriage ceremony so that it's legal.
So then they return to Virginia, legally married. But next thing you know, the local police raids their home in the early morning hours of July 11th, 1958, hoping to find them having sex, given that interracial sex was then also illegal in Virginia.
And even though they had the marriage certificate hanging on the wall, they were still arrested and found guilty and sentenced to 1 year in prison. With the sentence suspended on condition that the couple were to leave Virginia and not return together for at least 25 years, they packed up and left and went back to Washington, D.C.
But then, in 1963, frustrated by their inability to travel together to see their families in Virginia, Mildred Loving writes a letter in protest to Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, which started a court case that ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court And in 1967, it ruled that laws prohibiting interracial marriages were unconstitutional, changing the course of the history of America.
I mean, this story is absolutely incredible, and it's crazy that it was only legalized in 1967. Interesting that it was, one, the woman that wrote the letter, and also a woman of color who wrote the letter. Had she not done that, I mean, God knows when the law would have changed, right? How much longer it would have taken. Despite the Supreme Court's decision, anti-miscegenation laws remained on the books in several states even after 1967. In fact, the last state to officially change the law was Alabama, and that wasn't until the year 2000. Wow. So it takes another 33 years for them to officially change it.
That's crazy.
Which is our lifetime.
I mean, and you know, when you think about it, remember how shocked the world was when Prince Harry decides he's going to marry Meghan Markle? Or when Meghan Markle decides she's going to marry Prince Harry?
Yeah.
That was 2018.
I know.
And people were like, oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, definitely don't want to say that everyone was like that, because of course there was so much support. A lot of people say that it wasn't the racial aspect that they had a problem with, but there were of course racial undertones, and it's just mind-boggling that it still does exist today, those prejudice attitudes.
It shouldn't be, but when you look at the history, you're like, well, actually, yeah, that makes sense. And you know what's interesting, again, coming off of episode 2 and the definition of race and how it's completely inconsistent. So even in the laws of each state, there was a variety of scenarios. Like some states were like, well, first of all, it was mainly about protecting the white race. It was, nobody really cared too much, I think, if like a black person married an Asian person, except for those communities. But like, as far as the law and the state, I don't think they cared too much.
Yeah.
It was about maintaining the white race. And so some states, they were like, well, there can't be any marriage or sex between whites and blacks. Other states were like, well, whites, blacks, and Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And then there were some that were like, well, whites, blacks, Native Americans, Asians, and Filipino, which is, I'm like, Asians and what's, and the Filipinos, they got their own race.
Yeah, okay. Different category, all right.
But yeah, it just shows again, like, oh my God, there's just no consistency when it comes to racism. It's never based on facts or truth. It's always biases and prejudice and like craziness. But you know what? Interracial marriages have increased from 2% of married couples back in 1970 to then 7% in 2005, then 8.4% in 2010, and then as of 2022, about 20%.
Okay.
This is of the U.S. population.
Guess which city
has the highest rate of intermarried newlyweds?
I don't know.
It's similar to my name.
Honolulu.
So Honolulu has by far the highest share of intermarried newlyweds of any metro area analyzed. 42% of newlyweds living in and around that city were married to someone of a different race or ethnicity.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Our parents had multicultural, interracial, and interfaith marriages.
Yep. Oh, gosh. Yes, they
how
did.
How was it for you growing up in a mixed household?
Oh, okay. Let me go back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. Oh, God. So my parents, they met in England. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom and her whole family had come over from India. My granddad actually came over in the 1960s. And my mom came over when she was about 8 or 9 years old. And so, you know, she spent the majority of her life in England. But when she was around, I don't know, early 20s, she was doing a teaching degree in Milton Keynes in England. And she met my dad. And I think at first she said no to my dad, actually. Mm-hmm. And then he left and he went away on work. to Saudi Arabia. And then he had to come back to England because he had an ingrowing toenail. And so he had to get that operated on. And because of that, that brought him back. He then tried to pursue my mum again. And she eventually said yes. Yeah. And so they ended up getting married. And but I know it's a random story. But at the wedding, what I know is that my granddad and my grandma didn't come because my granddad was in disagreement with who my mum chose. And I don't know the ins and outs of it, but all I know is that for the first few years of my life, I think up until I was about 8, I didn't have a relationship with my granddad because he didn't approve of what she did at that time, because, you know, it was the 1980s. It was really scandalous for anyone to marry out of the Indian culture like that, let alone a woman. People tell me is that my mum was a complete angel, had never done anything bad. And, you know, this was, I guess, unforgivable in my granddad's eyes at that time. You know, he did change his attitude and his thinking in his lifetime. But at that time, it was like, you just don't do that. And so, he wasn't there. And my grandma, you know, obviously she had to, she wasn't allowed to go. And I think my mum's younger siblings weren't allowed to go. But I know that some of her older siblings could go.
Interesting.
Yeah, because, you know, they were able to have more autonomy, I guess, over their lives and what their decisions. Mm. They weren't under my granddad's roof. Yeah.
Wow. So for your first 8 years of your life, you had zero relationship with your granddad?
I knew of him, and we would meet my grandma in secret, arranged by my aunt, so that, you know, we could have a relationship with her. And I just remember things like going round to my grandma and granddad's house. They lived in Luton. I remember going round to see my grandma, and my, you know, a couple of my aunties would be there, but we would have to leave by the time my granddad got back from his club that he used to go to. He used to go somewhere to play cards and stuff. So we'd have to leave very swiftly. And it was weird because, looking back, of course, that's not really very a normal thing. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I didn't know any different. Oh, it makes me emotional. I knew I didn't want to leave my grandma, and I knew that I loved spending time with her. Like, I remember wanting her to plait my hair, and I kept saying, do it again, do it again, do it again, because it was just so nice to spend that time with her. And I remember people being emotional. Like, I remember my mom getting upset, and yeah, it was really hard. Mm. I mean, there are so many amazing things about growing up between the two cultures, but that was really difficult. Difficult to see my mom upset as well.
How many siblings does your mother have?
So she's one of seven.
So all of the other six, they stayed in the Indian culture, and she was the only one that...
Yeah, she's the only one that has married out of the culture. Wow. And again, I mean, my parents then divorced when I was around 10 or 11. But again, she's married another white man, Dave, my stepdad. Big up, Dave. Funnily enough, my granddad did go to that wedding because it was later in his life. And I guess, you know, he was less strict and less sort of that way of thinking. You know, by the end of his life, just to say, by the end of my granddad's life, I did have a relationship with him. You know, there was a lot that happened up until that point. We basically had an event where we were allowed back into the family.
Yeah, how was that?
It happened when I was about 12. I was in real trouble for something, I remember, and my mum was about to have the hugest go at me, and it was like a film. It was dramatic because suddenly the phone rang, and it was my auntie saying, come to Luton because I've spoken to Baiji and, you know, the family's going to come back together. And yeah, it was very emotional and also confusing as well. I just remember a lot of people being there, a lot of my relatives being there, and we were allowed back in the house, and there was no rush to have to go off again. I think I said Sashikar Baiji to him, and I think he put his hand on my head, and I think I cried, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Even though I was confused, and I was just like, what the hell's happening? But I knew that it was like, it was a moment where I just felt overwhelmed.
So before you did the welcome back party to the family, did you ever have any interaction with your grandfather?
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember the order of things, but I do have vivid memories of going round to the Luton house, and my granddad would be, you know, in the other room, and my aunties would say to me, you know, go and say Sashigar to Baiji. And I knew that was something that I would have to do, and I felt really embarrassed to do it because I knew that I probably wouldn't get a response, but I was kind of hopeful every time. And so I would, you know, go into the room and it would just be me and him, and I would say, put my hands together and say Sashrikal Baiji, which is basically hello. It's the way that you greet an elder, someone of respect. So I'd say Sashrikal Baiji, and he would ignore me. And then my aunties would say, did you say Sashrikal? Did you say it? And I'd say, yeah. I don't know if I would say, but he ignored me. But I felt so ashamed that he ignored me that I don't think I even told my aunties he ignored me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I sometimes used to wish that I was fully Indian, because I would see the way that he would greet my cousins and stuff, you know, with such warmth and affection. And, you know, unfortunately, I didn't get to experience that. So it's been something that's been really hard to kind of grapple with. You know, me and my brother, we both experienced that. And it is tough to talk about it because you want to kind of gloss over and just, you know, act like it didn't happen. But it did. And it, you know, I think my confidence did probably suffer. From then on, I'm not going to say that I had the best relationship with him, because those foundational years were not there, unfortunately. But, you know, I would see him and my grandma a lot up until when they passed away. And I learned how to speak Hindi when I moved to India. Mm. I ended up doing this Punjabi film. So my grandparents are actually Punjabi. And my aunt organized this big movie theater trip for the whole of my family. So she booked like 30 tickets, and my grandma and granddad came. And I could see that he was proud that I had done a film in Punjabi. Yeah.
I don't know why this is making me cry.
Yeah.
I feel like you didn't do anything wrong. Mm. You know, you didn't do anything wrong. You were just you, but you had to pay a price. And then you spend a good portion of your life like trying to prove that you are worthy, that you do deserve to be loved. I feel like a lot of us artists, yeah, we kind of have a little bit of a complex relationship.
You know, it's so weird because it wasn't conscious at all.
Of course it wasn't.
In my mind. But yeah, looking back, I feel like, God, there must have been a reason why I want, you know, I had this complete obsession with learning Hindi to the point that I was able to speak it and work in that language as well. And it did come down to wanting to prove myself.
And it must have felt amazing when he, yeah, when you saw that twinkle in his eye, yeah, that he was proud. And you see, look what you were missing out on all these years.
So, and also because it was a comedy and it was, you know, it was really funny, and I could see that they were enjoying it. Yeah, it was a great moment. Felt like a triumph.
I will get into my story soon, but just a little small kind of link. We didn't really have a relationship with our Japanese grandmother, mainly language barrier, also distance and all that. But I have this memory of this afternoon. My mom was taking a nap and I was in the living room, and I decided, I was about seven. I was like, I'm going to draw the most beautiful drawing of a flower for my grandmother. And this drawing is going to like prove to her that I'm a wonderful granddaughter, and like maybe entice her to want to, I don't know, be more in our lives somehow. And I kept erasing and drawing it again and erasing and thinking, it's not good enough. It's not good enough. It's not beautiful enough. It's not impressive enough.
Aww.
It's not a captivating enough drawing of a flower. You know,
yeah,
it was like some weird version of that in a way.
I know, the things that we do to get that connection.
My mother came from a family of Irish Catholic immigrants, moved to Australia, and then she left Australia when she was about 20 and ended up in Israel. She was actually gonna be a nun. That's why she came to Israel.
Oh.
Yeah. And then she met my father there, who left Japan when he was 30, I think. And he was raised in a Buddhist family, but ended up converting to Christianity, which was a big deal.
And in Japan he did that?
I think, yeah, in Japan. And then made his way to Israel. So these two people that traveled from the other side of the world and end up meeting in Israel. So my mom obviously didn't continue on her journey to become a nun. She met my dad. They fell in love and decided they were going to get married. It all happened quite quickly. And on my mom's side, they had two issues. Number one was that my dad was Japanese. So apparently my mother's grandmother, her youngest brother was taken captive in a Japanese war camp during World War II, and it completely destroyed him. He never recovered. He had extreme PTSD. And also my mother's father served in a secret unit in the Air Force, and his base was bombed in Darwin during World War II, and he lost a lot of friends. And so there was just a lot of tensions between Australians and Japanese, and the Japanese didn't really have a good reputation in Australia. And so actually my mother's grandmother, before my mom left Australia, she said to her, "Do whatever you like, just never marry a Japanese man."
Wow.
Yeah. And then he wasn't Catholic. That was a really, really big deal too. So my mom was telling me how after they got married, also they didn't have any family in their wedding. My mother's brother offered at the time to pay for my mother's father and his new wife to come to the wedding in Israel. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't work out for them to come. And then on my dad's side, actually two of his sisters were going to come and be bridesmaids. And then there was a big typhoon and they couldn't come. So they didn't have any family at all at the wedding. But then they get married and they have two kids at that point, and they decide to do this big trip to Japan and Australia all in one go. And while they were there, my dad's mother would every morning make them give their breakfast to Buddha, a portion of their breakfast to Buddha first, and kind of also being as long as you're under my roof, we're gonna do things this way, not the way you've and then straight from there, they went to Australia, and my mom told me how that first breakfast when they woke up and spent the night at their house, my mom's dad had laid out on the dining table all these news clippings, all these articles of how if you're not Catholic, you're going to go to hell.
What?
just some easy morning reading for my dad.
With a cup of coffee.
And that was really... upsetting for her. Yeah, so they weren't disowned, but there was definitely a lot of
tension
in the air,
and actions that were saying a lot.
Yeah, and then I remember also probably for my early years, we didn't really have a relationship with our grandparents. When I was born, I think by then my Japanese grandfather had passed. My Japanese grandmother did not speak a word in English. So that was tough. And, back then, it was really expensive to make an international phone call. So you had to communicate through letters and stuff like that.
Oh,
and I remember we didn't really, have a relationship with my grandparents in Japan or Australia. Mm-hmm. But my Australian grandfather and his wife did come to Israel for a summer. It was 2 months. And my mother put them up in an apartment in our neighborhood. And I just remember... it was the best thing ever.
Aww.
Because all of my friends had massive families like yours. They had so many grandmothers and aunties and cousins and second cousins. And every Friday they would go to their grandma's house and eat. And, and all of the holidays they would all get together. And we never had that family padding around us. And I was like so proud. I was like, I have my grandparents in the neighborhood, and I'll go to their house after school. Oh. I remember getting stung by a bee for the first time by a bush outside their apartment. Mm. And it hurt so bad. But then they came and they like put some cream on it and a Band-Aid. And I was like, my grandparents are taking care of me.
Yeah, you know? That's so sweet.
It felt so good.
Yeah. And also, when you're that age, your grandparents are the most fun people.
I mean,
they were for me.
For
like,
you.
Yeah. Like my dad's parents were definitely that for me when I was a child. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I remember my step-grandmother, she made like these cooked beets for me. And she just, there were sliced beets on a plate. And it was the first time I'd ever had a beet before.
Oh.
And it was delicious. I loved it. And I, again, had that immediate feeling of like, this is so cool. My, you know, food is such a big thing when it comes to nurturing and showing someone you love them.
Yeah.
And I remember eating those beets. Maybe they weren't that good, but to me, they were delicious because she was giving them to me.
Yeah.
And after that, I think once they came to Israel and they saw us and we were able to establish that relationship, it's amazing what FaceTime can do. Then they started to call us on birthdays. They started to send us birthday cards and birthday gifts and to call at Christmas. But it still, that was about it. It was, there wasn't more than that. So from then on, it was like, it was friendly. I have these friendly grandparents that live really far away. I don't know too much about them, but at least we're on good terms.
Yes, and at least there's contact.
Yeah. We did go a few years later. We went to Australia. And we were visiting my grandparents and it was time to leave. And my step-grandmother burst into tears. And she was like, it was like all those years again of missing out on us just came up and flooded her. And my parents decided, okay, let's let Hannah and the two younger ones, I think it was only the three of us on that trip, spend the night. And so we spent the night and had that time with them. And also we were amazed to discover there were all these framed photos of us all around their apartment. And it was like, wow.
Oh,
I didn't know.
That just made me like get tingling.
Yeah, I didn't know all these years that we meant that much to them, you know.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
And there was, I was like, all these pictures. And I mean, I credit my mom for that. I think my mom, she worked so hard at keeping the communication channels open. She was very good at writing letters and sending updates and sending pictures. And all those pictures she sent, I think those are the ones they framed. And I remember her bugging my dad to write to his sisters, to write to his parents, to give them updates. You know, when I did go to Japan as an adult, when I was, I think, 25, my grandmother had just passed away. I missed her by 2 months, which I was sad about. And I came to this old traditional Japanese home that actually ended up getting ruined by the tsunami afterwards. So it's not there anymore. But back then I was able to go there to this house. And there we were, us family and five kids. There was like this really special corner of the living room / kitchen. We were on the wall there. And I couldn't believe it. I was even more surprised that my Japanese grandmother gave us like this place of honor in her home. That really moved me.
Yeah.
You know, there was, even though she wasn't proactive in communicating with us, I'd like to think there was some sort of a yearning on her part.
Oh, I'm sure there was. I'm sure there was. Seriously. You know, that, not to bring the conversation back to me, but
no, give me a break here.
No, my...
I feel emotional.
It's an emotional episode. My grandparents, they had a wall of our graduation pictures that everybody, thank God everybody in my family has graduated. Because otherwise it's like, but yeah, everybody in their gowns and their scriptures, you know, they had all of the pictures up of all the grandchildren. As soon as you got your graduation picture, that was it. I can't wait to be on Bibiji and Baiji's wall. And even when they moved out of the Luton home and they moved into my uncle's house and they had a room in the back of the house, that wall was covered with the graduation photos, and it's still there. And I went there recently, and I just remember just looking at that wall and just, I don't know, just remembering them and just feeling the pride that they would have had over this legacy that they've left behind of all of us. Yeah. It's, yeah, I don't know, yeah, I miss them. Okay, let's move on.
Let's take a moment to blow our noses. We're very emotional today. Do you need a tissue?
I've got one here. What was it like for you? I mean, we've talked about our grandparents and our relationship with them, but what was it like for you just on a day-to-day basis growing up, not only in Israel, but with these two other cultures in your household, you know, with your dad being Japanese and your mum being Australian? What did that look like?
We had, you know, you had to take the shoes off before you came into the house, yeah. Which like now
I do that. I love that.
Yeah, a lot of people do it now, yeah. I feel, but like back then it was different. From my friends. Yeah, it was like, in Hanalei's home, you take the shoes off and there's like a place for your shoes. And I had to ask my friends, and I was a little almost embarrassed sometimes, yeah, to ask them.
I've had those moments too, yeah.
We took a lot of baths, and we had a rice cooker, which was non-existent in Israel. I don't even know if they sell it these days. And we had nori, you know, seaweed that was from Japan. Yum. That we would get sent to us, or my dad would bring. And both my parents had like a stash of like their goodies, you know, from Japan and Australia.
Yeah.
My dad would have all these, he'd had these like crunchy, salty fish and stuff we didn't want to eat. But, you know, we ate rice every day as well. Mm. Rice with seaweed, soy sauce, and then like a schnitzel.
Oh my gosh.
Just like an Israeli
just put it all together.
Yeah. And then we had like Japanese art on the wall as well, and like different things around the house. We had like a boomerang from Australia and different trinkets that we'd brought back. We used to drink Milo. Have you heard of this drink?
I love Milo.
Really?
I got introduced to it in Thailand. Love it.
Oh, I thought you were going to say I introduced it to you.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was one thing that you didn't introduce me to. You've introduced me to a lot of things, but
Yeah, so
mushroom coffee the other day.
No, it's really good. Even though it's an energy drink, that was like our hot chocolate replacement. It was like our comfort drink, and we would drink it in the evening, or if you had a long day and you were just kind of emotional, then a cup of Milo.
I need one now.
I know. Where's our Milo?
Tabitha,
where's our Milo?
Tabitha's our imaginary assistant.
Yes. That's what I can think of right now. Oh, so when like friends would have birthdays and stuff.
Yeah.
My mom had this bag full of all kind of like pretty things from Japan, kawaii things, like beautiful handkerchiefs or origami. You couldn't get that in Israel. And so that was like a really special gift I would give to my friends.
Was that what was in your party bags when you sent your friends home?
No, I didn't have party bags. But if I went to a friend's party,
yeah,
that was the gift I would give them.
That's amazing.
And initially it was like really cool. But after about the 10th friend's birthday, I was like, okay, I think they're starting to pick up on the fact that like we're just pulling these gifts out of a bag. And like, you know, I started to feel a little bit embarrassed that like, oh God, mom, do we have to give them another Japanese gift? Like, you know, they already know what it's going to be. It's going to be a handkerchief, you know.
No, oh my God, origami paper. Are you kidding me? I would have loved that. But yeah, I understand, because I used to feel embarrassed about things like that. That looking back on now, I'm like, that's so cool.
It is so cool. It's special that my mom did that too. That she was like, no, this is a part of you.
Yes.
Share it with your friends.
Yeah, that's really lovely.
Yeah. Also, it was easy instead of having to go buy a gift or whatever. But
yeah. Just take something out of the big bag.
The gift stash.
You were just talking about food then, and something we do in our house is sometimes we'll have like Indian, something like a sabji, which is a vegetable dish, or a dal, but then my mom will combine it with coleslaw.
That's great.
It's like a bevy special. That's what we call it. Yeah, we have all sorts of things flung together like that.
How was it for you with your parents and the different cultures?
You know, I was really thinking about this last night, even in my sleep, because in preparation for today's episode, it was just such a rich experience looking back, because sometimes at the weekends I'd be going to a barn dance with my dad, because he'd often take me and my brother, even when we were tiny, and we'd just get involved in the barn dancing. Maybe we wouldn't know anyone, but we'd befriend people.
I love a barn dance. Oh,
I know you do. Because I had one at my wedding and Hanalee went off.
Went off.
She did. She was her whoop whoop person right there. Yeah, so it would be barn dances. It would sometimes be family functions when we were, you know, back in the family. Bhangra at the weekends. Loads of food, Indian food. But then also on my dad's side, we would go around to my grandparents' house and have roast dinners and fish and chips. And it was just very, there was a lot of music. I think because my dad's a folk musician as well. And there was just a lot of, yeah, just a lot of culture. And being from that Indian family, again, in the later years, there was just so much love that we were always surrounded by. Like, my cousins are still my best friends. I would love to hang out with them. Like, for me, hanging out with my cousins is not a chore. It's the funniest thing in the world. In fact, if I ever found out that my cousins were on their way to see us as a young kid, I would do handstands and cartwheels because I'd be so excited. So weird.
Like a cartoon.
Yeah, I'd be like, yeah. Just so excited to see them. And yeah, I think that's a really unique
you think
thing.
A part of it was because of that start where you felt kind of cut off and separated from them.
So it was really special when they came.
Mm.
Yeah, it really was. How did what they went through impact you?
I've always wanted to love my parents and protect them and prevent all of that heartache from happening to them, you know. But when you're a kid, there's not, you kind of feel a little helpless when you're a kid. There's not so much you can do. Mm-hmm. And you're just being a kid and they're busy. They're trying to raise you.
Mm-hmm.
I think over the years, the more I look back at it, I have so much, bring out the tissues again. I have so much awe and respect for my parents. I think they're so brave for what they did. It's because of them, I think, that I was able to be brave too and go out into the world and go to New York and follow my dreams and then move again. And now, again, we're really far apart, me being in LA.
I know.
I think for both of us, so it's more common in Japanese culture that the woman marries out.
Okay.
So it was kind of more unusual that my father was the one who married out. And he was also the eldest son of five kids. And so it's expected in that society that you stay back and you take care of the family and the parents. And, you know, it's when he decided to leave that was a really big deal. Then he married a foreigner. And they thought, okay, but at least they're going to come back, right? We're going to bring the foreigner in back into our culture. And then he didn't. He stayed in Israel and he didn't move back to Japan. And that's when they decided, well, then we're going to take you out of the family inheritance.
Oh.
And actually, I mean, you know this, maybe some of the listeners do, but my dad actually passed away nearly 2 years ago. It's going to be, feels like yesterday. Yeah, I think I was able to go to Japan again after he passed. And I feel like I didn't give him enough credit while he was alive. You know, to how difficult it was for him to navigate being in this new country, being with a partner that's from a completely different culture, and yet a third culture with the kids. And he was such a outside of the box unique Japanese person for doing that. And when I was a kid, I just was like frustrated that he wasn't sometimes like my other friends' fathers.
Yeah.
You know, and like, why do I have like this Japanese dad that's like doesn't know what's going on here? But he was a pioneer, really. you know, my mom is here, luckily, and I feel like over the years I've just been able to understand their struggle even more.
Yeah.
And have more empathy for it and relate to it more. And yeah, I'm so grateful to them that they followed their hearts.
Yeah. But you can see that bravery in you, and it's what is one of the reasons why I love you, because you have that essence of, like, I know your dad through you. Yeah, and he would have been very proud of you.
Thank you.
This is turning into a very emotional episode. Everyone's probably like, stop crying, both of you, God. But you know, the bravery thing, I feel the same with my parents too, and especially my mum, because my God, I can't imagine what that must have been like in the 1980s to do that. It was not heard of. I know that my mum was gossiped about and said mean things about, you know, and faced so much horribleness from the Indian community, her community. And it makes me angry that she went through that. But also, I have to step back from things and, like, try and understand that, it, like I said earlier, it was such a scandalous thing to do and such a shocking thing to do.
Yeah. And also, in Indian culture, is it more common that the woman marries out, or that the
man. Every time I meet someone, they're like, oh, okay, so your dad's Indian. I'm like, no, my mom's Indian. Yeah. And every film that I watch about mixed marriages or TV series, it's always about the boy who marries out and the repercussions. It's never about the girl who marries out. Yeah. Which is, you know, I started writing a script last year about my mom's story, and who knows if it's going to see the light of day, but, you know, I feel I'm waiting for that.
Yeah.
To see that, you know, especially set at that time. Another way in which I feel what my parents went through impacted me was my passion for inclusivity. Yes. And non-division, because I saw a lot of division as a young child.
Mm.
A lot of things which I just kept inside and just shut away because of my parents' horrific divorce. But there was a lot of, for me, unnecessary division. And so that's why I decided I didn't want to, and this is no disrespect to any religious people, but I saw religion as divisive when I was younger. It doesn't always have to be that way. Of course it doesn't. I have, you know, I love going to the Sikh temple and I love going to a church, and I went to a Mormon church. My mother-in-law is Mormon, and you know, I love going to those places, but yeah, I think it really shaped me in terms of wanting to make sure that I stand for equality and inclusivity throughout my life. I feel like that is a good segue to our own weddings. Bring out the Bollywood Jewish
oh my gosh.
Mishmash of wedding that we had. Yeah, it was important for my husband Ethan and I to have a wedding that represented us, I think. So we definitely brought in, you know, some of the Jewish traditions and the Indian traditions. Like, for example, at the end of our ceremony, you remember, Ethan broke the glass and we got married under a huppah. And then my brother played the dhol as we exited down the aisle. And it was probably the best moment of my life, because it was just this, you know, this celebration and this outburst of, we've done it. And here is all of our culture coming together in the English countryside in a beautiful garden.
Oh, I loved it. There was the Bhangra music, which I was going crazy to. I was like pulling out all my freaking Bollywood moves.
You really were.
And
loved
showing
it.
All your family, like, I can do it too. I can do it too. And then your
twist
dad.
Those light bulbs.
I know. I was twisting it. I was like full on energy.
Yeah, you
and
were.
And then there was like the square dancing. And then we were, but all while eating like this delicious roast and sticky, sticky toffee pudding. Yeah. I loved your wedding.
Oh my God, thank you. What about you? What was your wedding like? Well, because we are both in interracial marriages.
Yeah, and intercultural marriages as well. So my husband's Swiss, He left Switzerland, and he's not your conventional Swiss person. He's like, you know, he's a very free spirit.
He is.
And when we decided to get married, he was like, let's keep it simple. Mm. Let's keep a low budget. And I was like, yeah, okay. But I was like, bud, where are we going to do it? Are we going to do it in LA? It's too expensive for people to come to LA. All of our family is so far away from us. Mm. Let's do it in New York. We lived there for a long time. Well, you know, let's do it in Switzerland. Switzerland's too expensive. Israel, if we do it in Israel, it's going to be my wedding. It's kind of complicated when you're in a mixed relationship to figure out some basic things like that.
Yeah.
So anyway, we decided to do it on neutral grounds. In Italy, we found like a special deal there. It sounds like really fancy and expensive, but it was actually more affordable than doing it anywhere else, believe it or not. And we did it in Italy. And then I was like, well, there's a limit to how many people we could have in Italy. We should do still a small event in Israel as well. So anyway, long story short, we ended up having 4 weddings.
What?
Yeah, but I feel good about it because I was able to do my mixed international celebration. It was like a wedding tour. And that's just how we had to do it. If we had both come from the same country, lived in the same town, mm-hmm. yeah, there would have been one wedding. But because we just had so many elements that we were working with.
Yeah, international.
And it was important for us to honor all of those elements. Mm. We did it that way.
Yeah.
And
oh gosh, it's complicated, isn't it? When you've lived in different places, your partner's from a different place, you've known different people in different aspects of your life.
Yeah. The one thing that was like tricky was that I was worried, again, I said this, like if we were to do the main wedding in Israel, Matthias and his family and few friends that would have made it out there would have maybe felt like, you know, like guests and not as comfortable, and vice versa if it was in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. So choosing to do it in a neutral place was actually amazing because nobody had a leg up on anyone else.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
It was amazing to see how our worlds came together.
Yeah.
I was so scared of that day because I was like, listen, I know Matthias and I get along, but we've never really had our families meet because we met in New York and then we moved to LA, Matthias and I, and so our families had never met. Our childhood friends had never met. And I was nervous. I was nervous, like, what if they don't gel? What if our worlds don't really match? And somehow it all came together. And it was really beautiful. It was also one of the most epic experiences of my life. And it just makes me think about interracial marriages, couples, or multicultural relationships. I think it is easier when you are not in the territory of one of the sides, that you pick a third neutral territory. It can be easier for the, it's hard that you have the distance from your family and friends, but you're both on equal grounds. I wonder if for your parents it was harder that all of the families were around, and I don't know.
You know, for Ethan and I, because I am here in LA and all his family are in California, it was just so meaningful, and we decided to go back to England. That felt like the right decision for us because I'm here. I guess it was just such a nice gesture for him and literally 50 Americans to come to my tiny little hometown in England.
Yeah.
I just, while we're on the topic of our own marriages, I just wanted to just talk about one thing, which I think is important to mention. So Ethan and I wanted to get married in a gurdwara, which is a Sikh temple.
Oh, yeah.
And we wanted to get married in the Sikh temple that I have been to since I was literally a baby. My mum would take me there. It's a specific Sikh temple in Milton Keynes. So when it came to us planning the wedding, because I was here, my mum went to the Gurdwara in Milton Keynes and said, you know, my daughter's getting married and, you know, we want to do a Sikh ceremony. Also, just to preface this, Ethan and I have both lived in India. We both have a massive respect for the Indian culture. Obviously, I'm half Indian. I speak Hindi. Been going to the Sikh temple for the whole of my life. But the head of this Sikh temple said, we're not doing interfaith marriages anymore, and we're not doing mixed marriages. That's a rule now. And it was just like a complete and utter kick in my stomach. I could not believe it when my mum told me. And she was hurt too because, you know, we'd just been going to this place every Sunday And my stepdad as well, my white stepdad, always felt accepted every single time he went in. We were suddenly like, okay, well, I don't think we want to come here anymore. And then I did a bit of research, and it turns out that a certain section of Sikhs, as in extreme Sikhs, a very, very small section, do not agree with interfaith or mixed marriages. And they actually go to Sikh temples when they find out that one's happening and ruin it with violence and take weapons and stuff. Mm. And so one of the big gurdwaras in Leamington Spa has had to hire security, or had to pretend that people are getting married on a certain day when really they're getting married on another day to protect them. So I just couldn't believe that this is still going on in 2022. This is still happening.
Mm.
Anyway, I just wanted to drop that in.
It's definitely still happening. I mean, we're just touching the tip of the iceberg here. I'm sure there's so many stories out there. By the way, we would love to hear from you,
yes,
about your stories or your parents' stories, mm-hmm.
Or what, you know, your relationship with your grandparents and how that was.
I feel like that was a major kick in the gut for you, given your history. They just tore open an old wound that you had, and you were like, here I am, an adult, and then suddenly it's like you're a kid again.
Yeah.
And your grandfather helpless. Doesn't want to talk to you.
Yeah, I felt frustrated and helpless. But this time I wanted to do something about it.
What did you do? What did you do?
Bang! I don't know what.
Did you just kick the door?
Yeah. We ended up finding another gurdwara who were amazing and so supportive. Yeah. And I'm so glad that we chose that one instead.
Yeah, I love.
I'll put it in the show notes about which gurdwara. No, I'm joking.
So, what are some of the cultural differences between you and Ethan? It's not easy being in like a mixed. I mean, it's not. Relationships are difficult. Doesn't matter. Because you're bringing two humans together that have had different upbringings, that have different messed up issues, that have different needs. And then when you add on top of that, so that's just life. And then when you're mixed, yeah, there is like this additional layer of the culture, the language, or how you're treated in society. And yeah, how is it for you guys?
There are definitely certain things, and especially when we first started dating, you know, we speak the same language, but there are a lot of different words that we use in England, which we don't necessarily use in America. You know, things like eggplant versus aubergine, and you know, there was a lot of that when we first got to know each other, and he'd be like, what are you talking about, Amy? Like, what does that mean? What is that word?
Yeah I've had that with you.
Oh, really?
Too.
Oh, with me?
Yeah.
Like, what
I don't know, you say different things, you have different sayings.
Yeah I know. I think another thing, and also this is with ex-boyfriends too, they've been quite overwhelmed with how big and tight-knit my family are and how much we show up for each other. I.e. when we went back in August, my mum threw me a surprise 40th birthday party, even though my birthday was actually in April, but because she wasn't with me, she decided to throw this big party for me. But we'd just seen those family members the week previous. So Ethan was like, what? They've all driven here again.
Why are we doing this again?
Haven't we just seen them? You know, but
they just keep coming back.
I think that's been a little bit tricky for him, and also for ex-boyfriends. Although Ethan, you know, he's from a big family as well, and he, don't get me wrong, he loves my family, but it's just, I guess that's a little different. Nuance difference. Yeah. What about you?
Well, so one of the things that keeps coming up again, and
it keeps coming up again.
I've gotten better. But okay, in Israel, you know, the culture is, and in the Middle East in general, is, you know, the way you show love is like you go overboard, right? Mm. If you have a guest that comes to your house, you better have a cake that you baked early that morning. You better have a stash of cookies, like a million options to offer food. And you ask them, you want a drink, you want a coffee, you want a this, you want a that. And Swiss culture is like not like that at all. You'll ask the guest, like, would you like some cake? And if they say no, thank you, then that's that. And I was like, what? What do you mean that's that? Of course they're being polite. Of course they don't mean no when they say no, thank you. They mean they're just being, you know, they just want to say no. But then if you ask them again, which is
They'll
say yes. And if they say no again, they're just being extra polite. You definitely need to ask them a third time until you basically don't stop until they take the cake. That's how we do it back home. But in Switzerland, it's like disrespectful.
Oh.
You need to believe them that when they say no, they mean no.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I was like, well, no doesn't mean no in Israel. It means let's play this game.
Yeah.
And so Matthias and I, we would get into fights over this because he would be like, you need to stop. You just need to stop. You're overbearing. You're doing the thing. And I was like, but you don't know if they're actually secretly hungry. They might be starving. You're going to let them leave our house starving.
That's your worst nightmare.
It's my worst nightmare.
I know.
It's my pride and joy to be able to like take care of someone under
my
roof.
Trust me, I know. I've seen it. It's amazing. I'm just thinking back to the baby shower that you threw me last year and the absolute spread that was outside our apartment with everything you can possibly imagine.
I did go around more than once offering cake to your your guests because I didn't believe them the first time. I was like, So that's just one. That's one little thing that, you know, and
go on, give us another.
I've been willing, though. I want to say that I have gotten better and and I will. Yeah, I have to kind of gauge it person by person now. And
I guess that there's that finding that new way of both of your ways of doing things and how you now move forward together.
Yes. It requires a lot of communication and listening. It does. You know, it really, really helped when I went to Switzerland and I was like, oh, this is a Swiss thing. It's not all just Matthias, my husband. A lot of the things that have impacted him and molded him into who he is obviously where he grew up. So I think that that can really help if you're in a mixed relationship to go to where they're from, visit if you can. I know it's not always possible, but I think that that really, really helps. I'm sure for Ethan, when he came to England and he met all of your family and you did the wedding there, like even for me, when I came to your wedding, I learned so much more about you.
Really?
It helps to have context.
Yeah. But also, I feel glad that we didn't do it in a city like London or somewhere where I'm actually not from. Like, you literally came to the village where I was born and was brought up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really meaningful.
I loved it. And you do have a huge family. I was overwhelmed. Yeah. I was like, oh my gosh, there's another one. There's another one. There's another cousin. They're all freaking gorgeous. Yeah. Supermodel family.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, all righty. Well, that wraps up the pre-recorded conversation Amy and I had before she had to sadly leave the podcast. It was so great just having her again. I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did. Amy, I hope you're listening and you enjoyed it too. You better be. Thank you, Amy, for sharing your stories, for being so open. And we all wish you a positive and easy birth, which is literally any day now. Baby number two, any day now. We mentioned this a little earlier, but what about you guys, my dear listeners? Do you have any stories around mixed relationships, marriages, families that you want to share? Oh, wait a second. We have a voicemail. Okay. You guys are in for a treat. I've listened to this voicemail, I think, 4 times already, and every time I crack up. I'm going to hand the stage over to our dear listener, Jem.
Hi, Hannah Lee. This is Jem. I have a fun multicultural story for you. So my husband and I have a mixed marriage with mixed children, and one time before we actually had kids, I make this Filipino dish called menudo, and it's basically a pork stew that has carrots and potatoes, etc., and you serve it over rice, and it's tomato based. So it's really good. He loved the dish for a really long time until one day I asked him to go grocery shopping for me. So my husband went grocery shopping and he asked for menudo. So I put down all the ingredients, and one of the ingredients is pork liver. And I told him he could find it in the charcuterie aisle, you know, with all the mixed cheeses and stuff. But he didn't know what it was. I couldn't remember the English word, so I just kept saying pork liver, it's pork liver. And so he just kind of walked around, and he gets to the store and he asks them for pork liver. And so they direct him to the pet aisle. And so he goes into the pet aisle and he gets a tin of, or like pork liver, but meant for cats. And he brings it home, and, you know, I've had pate before, but in Asian stores, you can typically get pork liver in a can, or you can just get it by itself. Or if you go to the charcuterie, you can get, like, a pate, and it says pate on it, pork liver or bird liver, whatever it is. So he comes home, and he hands it to me, and I'm like, oh, okay, cool. So I just cook with it. It doesn't say anything obvious, like Friskies or anything on it. It just says pork liver, whatever. And so I just open it up, and I start cooking with it. And so I finished cooking and I serve it for dinner and he's eating it and he goes, so where's the pork liver? Thinking he could just pick it out. And I said, what are you talking about? It dissolves. It dissolves into the flavor of the stew. And since that day, he would not touch menudo anymore because he did not tell me until much later that he had given me, yes, daddy, that was daddy. He had given me pork liver that was meant for cats. So there's our strange little funny story, and it took 8 years before I was allowed to make that dish again and serve it to him and he would eat it. So there you go. Have a good one. Bye.
Oh my gosh. Your husband is a cheeky, cheeky boy. 8 years. I can't. 8 years? He had to avoid your menudo because he was scarred from eating the cat food liver? Oh my gosh. Thank you, Jem, for sharing that story. I hope you guys got a kick out of it too. If you like this episode, please share it with someone that might find it meaningful. Please leave a comment, leave us a review, leave us a message. I would love to hear from you. So on that note, I'm going to say goodbye and thank you again to Amy. And Amy might pop her head in one more time this season, so be on the lookout. And I will see you guys next week. Bye! This episode was produced by me, music by Matthias Kunzli.